shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is basically because Star Trek Discovery is back and released a wonderful episode. I'm Andrew and with me today are...
Tishna.
And...
Ty.
How are you both?
Very well, if a tiny bit chilly.
Hmm. 3 degrees outside, 16 degrees inside the shed.
This is the kind of times when I wonder about the validity of doing these podcasts in the garden shed. We could easily do it in your kitchen and no one would know.
Yeah, it's true.
But we never do. We actually never, never, ever do, do we?
And are we awarded for our dedication? No, we're not.
Yes, we are.
Go on.
That's exactly what we are. We're awarded by the Guardian newspaper.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. We should mention that. Let's talk about that.
Yes. I think, well, if anyone's listened recently, though, you'll probably know that we were selected as one of the Guardian's favourite podcasts of 2018.
Get in.
We have not been so far named as one of the Daily Mail's favourite podcasts of any year.
Because there's too many brown people on this podcast.
This is very true, actually.
And, right, anyway, let's get on with a bit of Star Trek.
Brother, episode one of season two of Star Trek Discovery. Although, before we talk about Brother, should we talk about the short treks that went on Netflix?
Okay. We actually watched those after we watched Brother.
I had seen them before they went on Netflix because I was unsure whether they would ever get released here, and therefore...
How did you watch them?
My aunt, who lives in America, recorded them off TV for me and sent me a VHS.
Wow.
Is what my lawyer has instructed me to say, if anyone asks. Thank you, auntie. But luckily for UK viewers, they appeared on Netflix the day before.
They're quite hidden, though.
They were in the trailer section. Yeah. If you didn't know this... CBS commissioned 4 short mini episodes called Short Treks. If you watch it, Discover on Netflix, they are in the trailers section.
Trailers and more.
And you have to scroll right down to the bottom of that as well to find them.
And they're 4 just short stories. They don't add anything or take away anything from the ongoing story that's happening through Discovery. They're just little bonus adventures, and they're very enjoyable.
They were wonderful. I really liked them. And I did notice a thing. You know, of course, we watched it after. And I noticed that Saru mentions his sister.
Yes.
When they're talking about it in the main episode. And then we find out about why, you know, why he can never talk to his sister again. So I thought that was
quite lovely. The Brightest Star. That was my favourite mini episode. And it basically follows why Saru left his planet to become the first Kelpian in Starfleet. And it's a lovely little story, which for me kind of sums up why Star Trek's so great and why someone would want to join Starfleet.
Totally. Saru sums up to me why Star Trek is so great. I love Saru.
I'm glad he got a very short but very sweet origins tale. That was great.
And I have a feeling that won't be the last time we see his people or his planet. I'm sure we'll be going back there.
Yeah, I hope so. Although we are told that there is an unbridgeable gap between them now. I also would have to say that any time that Tilly's on screen, I'm happy too. So I was delighted to see her have a short trek.
I mean,
that was maybe a little too short for the character development.
It was very quick.
Yeah,
and I couldn't help wondering where everyone else was on the ship, apart from the one other time we see.
Yeah, she's the only person in the mess.
Yeah,
and then causes a mess. But for some, I don't understand how anyone doesn't like the character of Tilly because I think you always need that wide-eyed, you know, enthusiastic officer. And in, you know, the original series, it was someone like Chekhov. Mm. You know, it was Wesley. To an extent in the next gen. DS9 had Bashir, Voyager had Harry Kim, Enterprise had someone, I'm sure. I never got on board with Enterprise. It has its moments.
Yeah.
Who doesn't like Scott Bakula? But I love Tilly. I think she's great. I love everything she does.
Oh, speaking of Scott Bakula, I need to put right something that once went wrong in the previous episode of The Cosmic Shed when we spoke to Marina Sirtis. Because in the intro of that, I said that Tottenham were playing Spurs in the Carabao semi-final or something. And that doesn't make any sense.
That means they're playing with themselves.
Yes. What they were actually doing was playing Chelsea. And I'm sorry for that little error.
I'm surprised Marina Sirtis didn't pull you up on it, to be honest.
Yeah, she probably will when we see her at the play.
She's got a Tottenham tattoo.
Yeah, she has. So there is an outlier, though, I think, in the short treks.
The one that's set several hundred years into the future.
Mm. I kind of loved it, but it also made me sad. Because I was like, where is everybody? What's happened to
lots of questions.
Yeah.
I mean, fundamentally, Discovery as a ship is problematic for Star Trek canon. Because if you have a ship that can jump hundreds of light years in just a second, Voyager would have been over by its 10th episode. Something has got to happen to the ship which makes the technology impossible to replicate or duplicate, or Starfleet unwilling to take that risk. So it was very curious, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I liked it. It was a very touching episode.
Yeah, slightly reminiscent of Star Trek the movie. In that a ship becomes sentient.
Yeah.
I kind of like that callback.
Anyway. I feel like we haven't really heard the computer that much in the main series, though. We don't even know what her name is, really, do we?
No.
Well, it's just the computer. I mean, for years it was Major Barrett doing the voice, and maybe they don't want to, you know, have a ship's computer if it's not Major Barrett.
Maybe. Right, so there are going to be two more as well, I believe. And they're going to be animated, apparently. Mm. So after this season of Discovery, there's going to be two short trek animated things.
Are you sure? Are you sure this isn't just the new series they're proposing called Lower Decks?
I believe it's a separate thing, yeah.
Okay, because CBS at the moment is churning out new Trek series. So they have the upcoming Picard series, which is going to be great, with Picard dealing with the fallout of the dissolution of the Romulan Empire, which means that Star Trek 2009... is canon because Romulus was destroyed in that.
Amazing.
That's right.
And then they're doing a Section 31 series with Philippa Georgiou, the Terran Empress.
Yeah.
And her adventures working for Section 31.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what Section 31 is.
So Section 31 is Starfleet's secret service that technically shouldn't exist but has always existed. It is... Mm-hmm. What the Obsidian Order is to the Cardassians and the Tau Shiar is to the Romulan Empire. It's a thing that does everything it can to protect the Federation, even if that means killing people and doing some nefarious dealings.
Right. So that's not very Star Trek, right?
It's not very Star Trek. It was introduced in Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also, Section 31 also cropped up in Enterprise. So there's been lots of reworking it into canon. And then in Star Trek Into Darkness, Admiral Robocop, the Admiral played by Peter Weller, who played Robocop, was also working for Section 31. So Section 31's kind of become canon now. It's just interesting to see that it's almost like everyone now semi-knows it exists.
Yeah.
Whereas by Deep Space Nine, the revelation that there is this dark side to Starfleet is a surprise to everyone because they've been... very covert.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, everyone's like, oh, it's Section 31. Section 31, we all know Section 31, don't we? I've heard of Section 31.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting. Maybe they'll do something that forces them to go back into the shadows again, but...
Hang on a second.
What?
I get... Everyone's behind Picard, right? That is a... I don't think there's anybody who's ever seen an episode of Star Trek who doesn't want to see that series happening. Is everybody okay with a Section 31 series?
I guess it depends on how they do it.
Yeah.
Kind of how they play it. If it's all just suddenly really evil and they're just going around killing people willy-nilly and letting Philippa Georgiou get away with her evil ways, then it might be a bit weird. And
yeah, that's often not why anyone comes to Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
But on the plus side, a sci-fi series with an Asian female lead over the age of 50,
Absolutely. That's
worth toasting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And who doesn't love Michelle Yeoh?
No,
and I think they can get a lot more political with it. I think they're going to make it extremely, even more political than, you know, some of the big issues they've been dealing with so well and always have.
Like Battlestar Galactica did that. When Battlestar Galactica, its heroes started becoming suicide bombers and it allowed the series to talk about what terrorism is and... you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And torture. When is it okay to torture? It's not okay to torture.
Mm.
But they would do it all the time. And so maybe that will allow Star Trek to go and to explore that territory where we wouldn't want our heroes doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But if you've got a character who is from the Terran Empire and does nefarious stuff all the time, This is her bread and butter. Mm. So it could.
That's interesting. It could be. Yeah.
I just hope that they don't spread themselves too thin, try to do too much all at the same time, and then invariably things will get cut, and then, you know, what could potentially be a really good series might just, you know, die in the first four episodes or something. That's
the thing, because Alex Kurtzman, who's CBS has put in charge of the Star Trek universe, he's commissioned Lower Decks, which is going to be an animated series from one of the guys behind Rick and Morty, which is... Mm. You know, the officers that we don't get to see, people who do the night shift. And then there's also talk of a Starfleet Academy series. So that is five series of Star Trek. Mm. That is a lot. Yeah. And, you know, we've had it when, you know, Next Generation was ending, Deep Space Nine was starting, and the two series were running concurrently, and we also had films out, and Deep Space Nine and Voyager ran concurrently, and there were films in the cinema. So we've had, you know, multiple Star Trek series and films before, but not to this scale. And if they're all running at the same time,
yeah,
that is a lot.
Yeah.
And that's my only concern.
Yeah.
And then you're going to just... inevitably going to start having, like, plot holes and more universes to explain everything, and where in the series does it fall, and what's canon for one and what is for the other. Are all the script writers and, like, are they all going to have little catch-ups regularly? This is what happened in the Lower Deck and this time, you know, in Discovery and this time.
I mean, if it's all new characters and they can keep stuff separate, like, it doesn't matter what happens at Starfleet Academy.
Yeah.
Does it bother you when they get the timelines wrong and when they're talking about Sector 31 as if it's a thing that everyone knows about? Does it bother you?
Here's the thing. No. because if it did, you've got to let some things go. Now, people kind of get uppity that there are holograms in Star Trek Discovery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything's obviously more advanced than it is in the original series. Mm-hmm. And I get it. But you can't have the production design looking like it did in the 1960s. In the first few episodes of Star Trek, the original series, it wasn't Starfleet. It was called, like, the United Earth Probe Agency.
Yes, absolutely.
Spock was smiling. The uniforms were always changing. Sulu worked in botany. And the weird thing is, what I've noticed about Discovery, people are kind of going, well, what's this with Michael Burnham being Spock's sister? Mm. Spock never mentioned her before. And I was watching some original series episodes the other day. The main characters never seem to know anything about Vulcans or Spock. Mm. In a mock time when it's the mating season for Spock, apparently this is all news to McCoy about how Vulcans mate.
Oh God,
Vulcans and humans have been working together for decades. How can no one know this? How can Starfleet Medical not have a clue? Yeah. And then Journey to Babel, when you meet Sarek and Amanda for the first time. Kirk goes, Spock, if you want to go down to Vulcan and meet your parents, go do it. And he's like, well, these are my parents. How does Kirk not know his first officer's father is the Federation ambassador to Vulcan? This has got to be in his file somewhere.
Yeah.
It's... Spock is private about stuff to such a degree, no one seems to know what's ever going on with him. Or everyone is just completely unaware of what's going on in each other's lives. You don't know that he's got a half-brother called Cybok until Star Trek V. Spock keeps things locked down. So,
yeah,
you've got to let some things go.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And there's also, I mean, I'm okay with it. Possibility that she's dead by the time we, you know...
Yeah.
You know.
Don't say that.
Well, they might do it to us.
I mean, I think that's going to be the thread of this season, kind of what is the relationship between Michael Burnham and Spock. And it could be that maybe she brought out the more emotional side in him because she's human, and he rejected that, and maybe that's why she became more stoic.
Yeah. And clearly they've had some issues, even from when, you know, when she was brought in, etc. There seems to be some definite, he's not liking that his mother spent so much time. And they clearly had some kind of bonding phase, and then something happened, nightmares and something. And I mean, I think that's what we'll find out. But, you know, there might be a good reason for...
Yeah, I mean, if we count the cage as canon, Spock was laughing and smiling all the way through that first episode. But we're not saying that episode... never happened. So if you want to kind of explain why Spock was more emotional back in the day, this is your opportunity to do it. But if you're one of those people that's like, well, you can't have this because of this, and you can't have that because of that. Star Trek's ignored stuff before. People who whine about how the Klingons look, but then seem to have no problem with the original series, then how they look in the motion picture, and basically how they become the brutal savages in the original series to the samurai-like warriors they are in the next gen. You gotta let some stuff go. And Enterprise trying to reboot that into, oh, they use DNA from genetically engineered humans, and that's why their forehead's smoothed out. It's like, I mean, sure, but that is the very definition of fan fiction right there. Why not just say makeup was different in the 1960s?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the thing.
That was over-explaining it. Like, I almost didn't want that explanation.
You don't need it. It's just the fans are kind of like, well, you've got to explain why they look like that. No, you don't.
No.
You really don't. Just go with it. Use your imagination.
It's a conversation we have fairly often here on the Cosmic Shed about whether it matters if the science is right, and it kind of doesn't, as long as the story fits within itself, and it's sort of how it feels to me.
The science has to make sense in the universe.
Yeah.
So this is the whole thing about the spore drive. I don't mind it in Discovery if they explain why this technology isn't seen going forward.
Yeah.
You can have it now, but why don't you have it later? Something's got to happen where this technology cannot exist going forward.
And is it not okay for you that the impact that the spore drive has on the person or the animal that's driving it, that's too dangerous for them? Like, Stamets is saying he's not doing it anymore. They're not pointing. They've said in episode one, season two, episode one, they've said, until we find a way of doing it with something that isn't alive, we're not doing it again.
Yeah.
That's not good enough for you?
Yeah, but, I mean, Voyager would be like, does anyone want to volunteer to get us home?
Or do you want to
keep travelling through space for 100 years? Yeah. Like, I will do this for a few jumps.
Yeah.
Let's get home.
Although, if they had done that earlier on, then we would never have got to season four of Voyager when it gets really good. So... that's probably why they didn't do it.
I must admit, I did have an issue with the spore drive when it came up because of sort of mushroom space network, kind of. But I got over it. I got over it. You know, and giant tardigrades. It's like, oh, but then they had such fun with the tardigrades. And, oh, my God, this was, like, my favourite thing on the internet for a week was, I think sometime last December, there was this sudden news story about tardigrades. And I saw it first on the Star Trek Twitter page because I found out that tardigrade poos are ginormous for the size of a tardigrade. And these scientists had these hilarious pictures of, like, a tardigrade. And they're, like, fairly transparent when you picture them. So it was, like, this tiny thing about the size of half your finger. And the poo was pretty much from its head to its tail, pooing it out. And they just shared that photo and went, this explains everything. I was just like, yes, oh my God, please. So if anyone from, you know, the Star Trek writing panel is listening, do a short about that. Oh my God,
do a short.
Yes.
I mean, my main gripe about the finale of Discovery was that Starfleet sanctioned some sort of mission to blow up Kronos.
I know.
And Sarek was on board with it. I was like, hang on, this is... No one would be on board with this. I know you've got to end the war in, like, 15 minutes, but come on. There was a Klingon fleet at Earth, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, we've put a bomb in the centre of your planet? And that was the point I was like, hang on, what's going on?
Yeah.
Someone's just written themselves out of a scripting dilemma they put themselves in. But apart from that, I let that go. I'm on board.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Like, listen, we need to talk specifically about brother. But before we get there, we've just had a little chat about life and the universe, and there's a recent story in the science news about the Chinese Space Agency landing Chang'e 4 on the dark side of the moon, the far side of the moon, and a wonderful lander that's got with it a tub of seeds. And some of the seeds...
A space seed, if you will.
Yeah, if you would. Yeah, very nice.
There's a Star Trek reference for the five of you that get it.
And they put the seeds in the box, they sprouted, and then they died. And I thought that was kind of worth exploring, so I spoke to Nicole Kaplan at the European Space Agency about life on the moon and out in space.
I am a research fellow in exobiology. Exobiology is concerned with three main themes. That's the origin of life, the limits of life and then the possibility of life elsewhere. So I'm project managing 9 experiments, all to do with microbes in space, and there's one plant biology experiment as well, that are all destined for the International Space Station. So they're currently in development with some new technologies that have never been used in space before, for the purpose of biological research. And we are developing them here at ESA with our partner universities and researchers, with a view to have them launch later this year.
Awesome. That's really very, very cool.
It is exciting.
Is the goal of all this actually so that we can grow plants in space for astronauts to eat when we go out into space? Is that why this is happening?
Ultimately, because if we want to travel further out into space, if we want to do space exploration properly, and I'm talking about long distances, not just a few miles up to the ISS, okay, slightly longer than a few, but we're talking about over 200,000 miles to the moon, then we will be needing to sustain ourselves while we're out there and not rely on constant resupply. And that's also going to increase pressure on Earth's resources. Are we sustaining life on Earth at the moment? It's also another question that comes up. So we need to make sure that we can do both, and we can do both effectively.
Yeah. And so you're hoping that your experiments are going up later this year. What does that mean? Do you have to kind of book a space on a rocket, or how does that happen?
It's kind of how it works. There's a queue. I work in the SciSpace team, which is science in the space environment. Now, that's split 3 ways. There's physical sciences, studying materials and so on and so forth in space. There's human research and human-centered biology, cell biology, and also, interestingly, and this is a new development, space psychology.
Oh.
And that goes into things like looking at the effects of confinement and a limited social group in space, and all the kind of psychological implications that may have. And then there's also biology, biological organisms ranging from mammals to plants, also encompasses exobiology, which is my small but hopefully significant area of science.
And do you get to go, like when you get booked on a rocket, will you actually get to go and watch it, or do you have to be in mission control?
I thought you were going to ask if I get to go on the rocket.
Oh, no.
That would be dreamy.
Yeah, they need you there to do it.
I am hoping to go along to our upcoming launch for the project BioRock, which is headed by Professor Charles Cockle at the University of Edinburgh. And that is shipping our world first biomining facility, miniaturized biomining facility, up to the International Space Station to see the effects that microgravity has on, or may have on, microbes in space, microbes that are mining rocks for precious metals and minerals, with a view that if we do go out into deep space and we do want to start building a lunar base or building a Mars base, that instead of taking materials, precious materials from Earth, we could think about mining asteroids and mining comets.
Amazing, amazing. And when's that launching?
That's scheduled to launch late this summer.
Great.
And that will launch on a SpaceX flight from Kennedy Space Center.
So you're hoping to go there?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You need someone to come with you, I think, to record it.
I'll see if I can make a case.
Okay, so did you see the, how do you say it, Chang'e 4, am I right?
Chang'e 4, I believe it's called the Chang'e 4. Yeah. I saw some videos of a lander, which were awesome, but I had no idea that there were biology payloads on board until they were making the headlines. First plant to be germinated on the moon, and then the headlines which then followed a few days later.
Which they had died, right?
They had.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly so.
Yeah. They died because it's too cold on the moon. It's too cold for too long, and nothing is going to survive there.
Well, as it stands, yes, we don't have any technology that could sustain life in those extremes for that length of time, as you say. I mean, the temperature fluctuations on the lunar surface vary massively, and they can get down to about, I think it's about 170 degrees. So you'd be pressed to find a plant that would do well in that temperature. And on Earth, yes, we do have Arctic and Alpine plants that can withstand very low temperatures for entire seasons. But that is an extreme that we need to face. And then another factor is the type of plants that we're sending to the moon. Why? I believe this plant was an Arabidopsis plant, which is fascinating if you're a researcher, and not very interesting if you're anything else. If you're interested in colonizing the lunar surface for food production, you're not going to be fed very well on a load of Thaelcress, which is the common name for Arabidopsis.
Do you know whether they were doing this because they wanted to do some experiments and they were going to find stuff out, or is it literally so they can go, we had the first plants on the moon?
It might be a bit of both. From my understanding, the Chinese Space Agency put out a call to universities. Over 20 universities were involved in developing this mission. From what the pictures show, you have a germinated seedling of Arabidopsis in a completely sealed container. And my reaction to this was relief, because here at ESA, we take planetary protection matters very, very seriously. I thought, if that's not sealed, that could be a potential hazard. Mm. But it was sealed in the way that an astronaut would be in a spacesuit with a life support system, given all of their essential requirements for life. And this would have been a comparatively low tech version of that, but giving a plant what it needs.
Do we actually learn anything from them doing this? Because we already knew that plants couldn't survive on the moon. So what have we learned?
I think it would also be a display that, yes, you can grow things. Things will germinate. But sustaining life is very difficult. And maybe that's the message that China were hoping to send, was, look, you can do this, but a lot of work is needed to then sustain life on the lunar surface.
Thanks, Nicole. So, brother.
I feel something shift in him. It was as if he'd run into a question he couldn't answer. He didn't want to share it with me, with anybody.
And you have no idea what it might have been?
No. Spock's one of my bridge officers. I trust him implicitly. He asked me for time, and I gave it to him.
How long will he be gone?
Not sure. He had months, and months accumulated.
I loved it. I thought it was great. It was a bit unexpected. It kind of set up the whole series for me, and I didn't realise that this whole season was going to be about kind of... I kind of love thinking the search for Spock. But, yeah, you know, kind of, where is Spock? What's going on with Spock? What was the seven signals? There's so much. They set it up really well. I enjoyed it. I think I want to know more about Pike. I'm kind of convinced that he's not a bad guy now. I don't think they're going to pull off another evil commander, but something happened to them, you know, that some shit went down when they stayed away from the war, and I think they're all a bit sort of... Yeah.
There was a definite feeling in the room for us, wasn't there, when we watched it? Because I watched it again since. But when we watched it the first time, there was a definite sense of, whoa, who's this Pike? Is this the real Pike?
Exactly.
Is this going to be... Because you never know with Discovery, right?
Precisely.
He might be a Romulan
universe,
in disguise.
Other universe? Who knows?
But, yeah, he could be a Ferengi in disguise. Who knows? But he's not, is he? But then on the second watch, no, totally, he's Pike, right?
He is Pike, but I think... He's not revealed everything about what went wrong with the ship and everything too. What went wrong with Enterprise.
So Enterprise has had some sort of system-wide failure, which means they're going to be in dry dock for a few months. Mm-hmm. And as such, Pike's taking command of Discovery.
Yeah.
And Pike, at this point, is the very definition of a Starfleet captain. He's really loyal. He believes in his crew. And as he says, you know, in that episode, he's up for a bit of fun.
And Burnham, wherever our mission takes us, we'll try to have a little fun along the way too, huh? Make a little noise, ruffle a few feathers.
I look forward to it, Captain.
you know, Jason Isaacs actually did bring a lot of fun, but, you know, the evil kind of fun.
His fortune cookies.
Yeah. I love Anson Mount as Pike, and I think he does a great job because when you see the cage, Pike is a little bit kind of cynical about Starfleet. He's thinking about jacking it all in. And at this point, the Enterprise has had its first 5-year mission, and they were too far away to get back for the war. But now they're back, even though they have the newest uniforms. they clearly stopped by Starfleet Depot, picked up the new uniforms.
Do not covet thy neighbor starship, Commander. Besides, we got the new uniforms.
And lovely uniforms they are, Captain.
Very colourful.
But yeah, I mean, that the fact that they were off exploring, as they should have done, instead of being there on the front lines, that'll be interesting to see if they explore that, especially as they are going to be bringing the character of Number One, who is played by Major Barrett in the cage and is played by Rebecca Romijn in Star Trek Discovery. So I think he's great. I don't think there's any mystery going on with Pike. It's just going to be about how he integrates with the crew, and I can't wait to see what happens. For me, the best new addition to the cast was Tig Notaro as Jet Reno, the dry as a desert engineer who's just amazing. Been keeping a bunch of Starfleet officers alive for 8 months.
I saw the Federation insignia, so I didn't vaporize you.
Who are you expecting?
Are you kidding? Maybe someone with a batleth? Never need to see another one of those for the rest of my damn life. Greg's head wound keeps opening up. Poor guy.
Holding in a Tellarite's brain.
Yeah.
I thought she was great.
She was amazing.
I know she's a stand-up comedian in America, and I'm vaguely familiar with her work. I've seen her on a couple of talk shows, but judging from her introduction in this episode, I can't wait to see more of her.
Yeah, there's a definite feel that season two is going to be more fun, right?
Yes.
Less dark.
Less war. I think it's less about how are we going to deal with this war and it all being kind of...
Which is good, because Star Trek shouldn't really be about war. It should be about exploration and discovery. And Alex Kurtzman, who was the showrunner, who wrote the J.J. Abrams, well, the first two J.J. Abrams movies, he's clearly injecting that bit of action into the series. So that bit where they're taking the pods down to the planet, that is essentially, you know, from the first J.J. Abrams film when they're skydiving onto the planet and you have a cocky officer who's inevitably going to get killed.
It was so great, though.
Was it inevitable?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, come on. We were watching it and we were like, oh, it's going to be the girl. And then about 3 seconds in, when he kept going, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I mean, she was wearing a red shirt, but...
Yes, exactly.
You know, he's a Starfleet officer. He should know better than to kind of mansplain to someone who's just been decorated by Starfleet.
That's an order!
Sir, she didn't alter the computer's flight patterns to adjust for the gravitational fluctuations. I've got this.
You can't rely on sensors!
Don't question my calculations. My roommate at the Academy was Parkation, and she was a year ahead of me, Burnham. But I told her what I'll tell you. Just relax and let me do...
No!
Connelly!
But also, he wasn't just mansplaining to her. He also just straight up did not listen to his captain.
I mean, no one wants to revel in a Starfleet officer who's probably really great at his job being killed so tragically. But he was a dick.
Yeah.
So therefore...
He was.
Well...
And he also suffered from not being Spock, because the first time you see him on screen, you think he is. And you're like, oh my, this is... And it wasn't.
I mean, if we
yes,
that
the
way,
the zoom in on his ears. Big giveaway. Yeah, but I thought it was really good fun, and I thought it was a great introduction to the tone of the new season going forward, which is going to be, we're still Star Trek, and we're going to have fun with it.
Yeah,
which is great, and I love the fact that they're introducing all the other bridge crew, like Reese, Bryce, Dietmeyer.
Yeah.
The one who's got the implant from her battle wounds. And I can't remember the black con woman's name. It begins with an O, but she's great. I love the fact that the helms woman, or the helm officer and the navigator are both women that work great together. And you know what? It's just great to see a lot of diversity on the bridge, as it should be. And not just humans. I love the fact that the show has the budget that you see a lot more aliens in the Starfleet. Because it's something you couldn't really do in the original series in Next Gen, but the fact they've just got that Saurian officer who sneezes on Lieutenant Cuddly in the lift.
Oh, man, I love that.
And you've just got Atrium that I don't know what she is, whether she's an android. She can't be an android.
Yeah.
I like the fact the transporter chief had a rudimentary visor, you know, like an early generation version of what Geordi eventually has. So you've got disabled officers and Starfleet.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
I like that they didn't just paint someone green.
Yeah.
Which is the normal cop out.
I love the roll call. I love the, you know, who are you?
Yeah, I don't know who any of you are.
Yeah. And we don't, right? And that's a, if anything's a favourite of the... Well,
we just don't remember.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
We saw you all last season. Yeah. Just remind us of what your names are again. Bryce, Reese.
If I wanted to say... But if I was going to say, what do I want to see from season two, it would be more fun...
Which, when Pike goes, where's the red thing? Where's my damn red thing?
Yeah,
it's like,
totally.
It's like for a red thing.
Tilly's hilarious. And I want to see, I want to know more about the crew. I want to feel that there's a team bond there, and there's definitely that.
I also want to know what the seven things are.
Over the past 24 hours, Federation sensors picked up seven red bursts spread out across more than 30,000 light years. They appeared in perfect synchronization, just long enough for us to get a reading, and then just as suddenly disappeared. Except for one.
Well, such precise synchronization all but rules out the chaos of natural phenomenon. Are they some kind of signal?
That's what we're calling it, but I'll leave the rest to my science officer. Your ball, Connolly.
Well, they're spread out all over the galaxy.
Yeah,
when they said it's like,
literally...
how could you possibly see that on the other side of the galaxy? You're not going to get to it.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff's in the Delta Quadrant.
I went sort of properly science with that, but I was like, oh my God, it's like it, the way they show it. For really big, bright things across the galaxy like that. It could only be something like quasars. We're not supposed to have quasars across the galaxy. So I was thinking, I kind of like that it's a natural phenomena, what's going on thing, but I'm looking forward to seeing, has it happened because of something like with the mirror universe, or is it like
Tishna, I have a science question for you, because was something that I thought when they have that briefing where they went, all these things happen simultaneously.
Mm.
And I was like, but if that's on the other side of the galaxy... The time that it will take the light to reach Starfleet's listening stations, that will be years. So how do you know it all went off simultaneously? Or is the light from that explosion, wherever it is in the galaxy, so fast, which is impossible? I don't understand. How could all those flashes happen around the galaxy simultaneously?
Well, I like to think that by this point, because Starfleet is so spread out across the galaxy, they have worked out some kind of system of, like, galactic time.
But they're not spread out all over the galaxy.
They're only
part of the Alpha Quadrant. I mean, this is why the Enterprise is out there exploring.
That's true.
I like to think that Star Trek is so advanced that they can work out how far away something is. And
well,
they've worked out...
Yeah. So maybe they have.
That they all went off at the same time. They all arrived at different times.
They arrived at different times. Or that they all...
But it could have, like, that they all happened simultaneously 500 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. That was a definite just go past the science.
So the very first... the opening of the episode is incredibly wonderful with the Cassini imagery.
Mm, oh, my God, I love that.
Yeah.
Space. The final frontier.
I did kind of giggle a bit though, because they made the Cassini imagery, which is from now, look like it was from 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Kind of like
that's
shaky.
Kind of funny,
like, but I was like, well, maybe they're looking at it with an Instagram filter. It's fine.
Yeah. But there's that. And Burnham is telling a story which is sort of a little bit faithy, right?
Yeah, it was very like African tale. That's what she said, African princess, and a little bit like almost like a, I don't even want to say it, but creation myth.
The tale of a girl who dug her hands in the wood ash and threw it into the sky to create the Milky Way. And hidden there, a secret. Buried among the eternal stars was a message. An enormous letter in a bottle made of space and time, visible only to those whose hearts were open enough to receive it.
Then, later on, Pike says that Spock taught us that logic was the start of things, not the end.
Mm.
I feel like this is maybe taking us along a sort of faith-religion angle.
Possibly. Maybe that's one of the things they'll wrestle with.
I mean, faith, again, versus science.
Mm.
has come up in Star Trek a lot, especially in Deep Space Nine, where you have the Bajorans, who are completely faith-based, and Sisko's evolution from, I'm just going to call them wormhole aliens, to, you know, he believes in the prophets by the end. He embraces his role as the emissary. And Kira Nerys is an incredibly religious character, and her clashes with Odo over his kind of stoic logic and her faith in something bigger is a continuing thing. So, hey, I'm happy for the series to kind of try and broach those series, and it'll be those questions. It'll be interesting to see what Spock's take on it when he inevitably shows up.
Yeah.
I can't wait for that. Do you think it's going to be in the next episode?
No, I think they're going to... They're going to stretch it. I think they'll have lots of flashbacks. They'll have flashbacks, but I think you can't have too much Spock. I think you've got to ration him.
Do you reckon?
Yeah.
I want to see him soon.
Because otherwise you're just putting him ahead of all the other characters.
Yeah.
And this is Discovery, it's not the Adventures of Spock. He's Spock. And he's played by the grandson of Gregory Peck, so he's going to...
Oh my God, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, bloody hell.
Atticus Finch, his grandson, is Spock.
Amazing.
So, it'll be interesting to see. But I think they'll use him sparingly.
Mm.
Well, I hope they do.
Yeah. In the intro, it says something along the lines of there is a message in the universe that only if you have your ears open to it will you hear.
Mm.
Which is slightly reminiscent of the end of Contact.
Mm. Mm.
Where there's the maths is the message.
So, I mean, right? I kind of like the idea of, and it's, like you say, similar to Contact, and much more recently, similar to, Interstellar and Arrival, in highly, highly, even more advanced aliens trying to gently
nudge you. Well. Yeah.
So, I mean, I kind of love the idea of us, like, of Starfleet not being the really advanced aliens, you know, deciding which other civilizations to talk to, but there's even more advanced aliens kind of going, ooh, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
That would be quite exciting if they go down that route, but I don't know.
It sounds kind of fun. If it does go down the faith route, that's quite good, because I'm planning an episode of The Cosmic Shed where we look at the relationship between science and religion.
Mm-hmm.
Are we doing Contact again?
No, we're probably not. We're probably just going to get... As a guy that I know, a very good chap, called Jordan Culver, who's written a wonderful... comic about the interface between science and religion.
Really?
We're going to get him in the shed and talk about that.
Cool.
With a few other people. Mm. Personally, I used to have a faith and I lost it, and I felt a little bit like Pike when I lost my faith, going, where's my damn red thing? but it's okay, because I found the rest of the universe, so it's okay. But... The candles. Burnham's candles.
I love the candles. Because I was all ready to go, where the fuck did you get that many candles from?
That's a lot of candles. And a fire hazard,
And then it was like, zoom. Oh, nice one. Nice touch.
I also like Spock's quarters. A little nod back to... They had that grating that's in the original series. They had the Vulcan thing with the bells on during the battle scene in A Mock Time. Three-dimensional chess.
It's
the doors seemed much bigger than in the original series. It's like, those doors are massive. But I like the little, the original series door swish.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it doesn't look like the original series, right? It has hints of it. It's like a retro futuristic version of it.
Yeah.
But it looks beautiful, right?
It looks great, and it doesn't look like how it did in the J.J. Abrams films, which, you know, critics say it looked like an Apple store. And they weren't entirely wrong in that design. The corridors were massive, and it didn't feel like the cramped cruiser that it was. But yeah, we have yet to see any more of Enterprise, and I'm sure we will. And there was that scene where Pike and Burnham were looking out the window as Enterprise was getting towed by a couple of tugs. And she was like, I've got to go over to Enterprise. And I was like, yes, go. I want to see what this Enterprise looks like.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if we'll see the bridge. What will that look like?
Yeah. So, how I want episode two to start, with Burnham just walking around. And then we get to see that whole thing.
I think she might. There might be more of her just talking to people, trying to suss out what you know, Spock's last moments before he left on his journey.
I think if there's one thing about Pike that I'm slightly disappointed by, is that I wanted to see this crew on their own going out.
Yeah, I'd like to have seen Saru in command longer.
Just leave them be.
But I get the feeling that maybe Captain Pike will just be around this season and will go back to Enterprise to resume his command, and then hopefully Saru will get command, because this is only a temporary thing while they investigate this mystery that I imagine will only last for this season. Anson, as much as I love Anson Mount, and in all the interviews I've seen and read with him, he appears to absolutely adore Star Trek and be a massive fan, and he's great, and I love what he's doing. But I think there will be just a temporary role for this season, and then maybe next season Saru will get the big chair.
Okay, I'll be down with that totally. Is it definitely season 3?
I assume so. This is it. By all accounts, Discovery's doing very well, and CBS seem to be pouring money into Star Trek.
Yeah,
so can't see why not.
Lovely stuff. But we thought we'd have a little look at some of the Star Trek that never happened.
Over the years, Star Trek has had numerous seasons, series and movies that didn't get off the ground. And I was just going to talk about five of my favourite potential ones. So I wanted to start off with, naturally, Star Trek Phase 2, which was going to be the follow-up series to the original series. And basically would have come out in 1977. The plan was that it would be the next five-year mission of the Enterprise. Kirk would have been in command, and then they had loads of new characters because Leonard Nimoy didn't want to return, so they would have had a new Vulcan officer called Zon. Lieutenant Ilea would have been there. There would have been a new first officer in the form of Decker.
Nice.
But unfortunately, none of this ever happened. The plug was pulled, but all of the elements that they had been developing, a new refitted Enterprise, kind of got rolled into Star Trek the Motion Picture. So the first episode, In Thine Image, about a sentient spaceship looking for its creator, characters of Ilea, the characters of Decker, they were all put into the motion picture.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the refitted Enterprise design essentially became what Discovery looks like, that triangular hull shape. Also in the 70s, while they were deciding whether to do a TV series or to do a movie, there were lots of potential movie ideas. Basically, they came down between two called The God Thing, which was Roddenberry's proposed script, which again was essentially the motion picture idea about a refitted Enterprise dealing with a malfunctioning spaceship that had come to believe it was a god. And then there was another planned script called Planet of the Titans. So there are lots of Planet of the Titans. So this would essentially
Planet of the Clash of the Apes.
Yeah. It was written by Chris Bryant and Alan Scott. And so Planet of the Titans, there's lots of kind of books that have been written about this, but it would have seen the Enterprise finding themselves on a planet that they believed was inhabited by the ancient Greek gods, the Titans. And then through some sort of Star Trek MacGuffin, the crew would have travelled a million years into Earth's past, and Kirk and co. would have accidentally taught primitive man how to make fire, and then discovered that they themselves are the Titans of men.
Oh my god, that's amazing. Like Stargate Atlantis meets Battlestar Galactica meets Star Trek.
So
just all thrown in there.
Apparently there were loads of directors that were courted, like Coppola, Spielberg, Robert Wise and Kaufman, but essentially that was shelved and the motion picture happened. Paramount threw its entire energy into Phase 2, which never happened, and then the motion picture happened. And then, you know, all the various series happened, Next Gen, and then when Enterprise went off the air, there was plans to kind of get a new rebooted movie series coming. And so in 2005... Paramount commissioned a script for Star Trek The Beginning, and this was written by Eric Gendronson, who had written for Band of Brothers. And what he wanted to do was to bridge the gap between Enterprise and the original series. So kind of like what Discovery is about, and would have been all about the Earth-Romulan War. And he described his idea as basically a big kind of epic sprawling sci-fi adventure, which would have featured a couple of ships and all new characters. He wouldn't have had Kirk there. He had a character called Tiberius Chase.
Oh, yeah.
So
how different.
Who inevitably becomes some hero of Starfleet to a point that Kirk gets his name as his middle name. But basically there was a regime change at Paramount and the idea got shelved, and eventually they rebooted Star Trek with Star Trek 09 with J.J. Abrams. Basically, a lot of the complaints about Discovery is that it's set in the past, canonically, and people want to know what's happened in the future. Over the years, there have been two series that have been proposed that would set Starfleet further in the future. The first one was an animated web series that was developed in 2006, or was being developed, and it was called Star Trek Final Frontier. And this would have been set in 2528, and it would feature on the latest Enterprise, but it's a much different future. It's quite a bleak future. So basically, there would have been a war with the Romulans that had ended in the 2460s, and basically, because of that war, vast areas of the galaxy are impassable and unlivable. So because of that, this causes a split in the Federation. The Klingon Empire is taken over by the Romulans. The Vulcans leave the Federation because they want to pursue reunification with the Romulans. And Dory is destroyed. And basically, Starfleet is reclusive, they're a bit darker, and they're a bit more suspicious. And from that, you have a new captain called Alexander Chase, who wants to bring back the old days of of seeking out new life and new civilizations. So he refits an old kind of war cruiser into an exploration craft, and it would have basically been him and his crew, which would have included characters called Commander Holden, Lieutenant Donald, and Lieutenant Commander Mr. Zero.
That's a terrible name.
Yeah.
Mr. in there.
I don't know, but basically it was that you can see some of the concept art. It was going to be an animated series. Alexander Chase looked very much like your Kirk archetype. There were security officers that were augmented with Borg implants.
Nice.
And it sounded quite cool. Another series that takes a similar, darker tone was proposed by Brian Singer, who, let's say, has fallen from grace somewhat.
Yes, let's say that.
But he's a big Star Trek fan. He even has a cameo in Star Trek Nemesis. So his pitch was for a series called Star Trek Federation. And this would have featured all new characters. And it would have been basically set in the future after Nemesis. It would have basically let Star Trek breathe. And it was going to grapple issues of the day, such as diversity, government power, gender frictions, and wars on foreign soil. His idea was to take the Star Trek universe, turn it upside down, and shake it vigorously. And it would have been set in the year 3000.
Whoa.
So basically, in the year 3000, the United Federation of Planets is not well. The golden age of peace has passed. Basically, it's in dry rot. Humans have become fat and happy, like in Wall-E. They're complacent. They've given up exploration for incremental colonization. Younger members of the Federation have left because the Federation's become too human-centric. Vulcans have just disengaged and have joined forces with the Romulans.
Mm-hmm.
Bajorans have become very insular and basically made their own religious federation, like a big planet-sized Tibet. The Klingons have undergone reformation and have basically become a civilization of warrior mystics. The Cardassians, after the war, basically have become a society of artists and philosophers. And the Ferengis are no longer a joke, but are one of the most powerful forces in the galaxy. Equality for females has basically made them replicate the Federation, what it was during its peak of its power.
Yeah.
And Starfleet's just a mere peacekeeping force, not doing much. So this would have followed the USS Sojourner, commanded by Lieutenant Commander Alexander Kirk. And basically...
Any relation?
Possibly might be. He's the first officer under Alden Montgomery, who's like a Captain America of the Federation, but he gets killed off early. There would be a feline-esque security chief.
Okay.
Genetically enhanced humans. Also, a crew member called 76 Distillation of Blue, who would have been a member of a gaseous species who wore motion suits. Oh. So kind of like Hellboy to the Golden Army. Majul would have been this Enterprise computer, the Multitronic Architecture Junction Energetic Library that runs the ship.
Okay.
And basically would have just seen the various tensions, loyalties and connections between the crew, and it would have shown a very divided and torn apart Starfleet.
Yep.
And Lieutenant Commander Kirk trying to get everyone together.
So when is Discovery set?
What Discovery is set 10 years before the original series is.
So what year does that make?
That makes it 2250, around there.
2250. Oh, so then that short was 1,000 years in the future.
Yes.
So vaguely around this time.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So,
and it did look quite abandoned bleak. Ship, didn't it?
Yeah.
So, and the guy didn't have any, like, he didn't mention Starfleet. He didn't go, oh, this is clearly a Starfleet ship. You know, he was like, what this?
So a lot of these series that are set far in the future, they wanted to get away from Starfleet being a utopia and being something more akin to Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
Which would have been interesting to kind of turn a mirror on how we are now. But I've always felt that Star Trek should be aspirational.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't really want to see a Star Trek series where humanity's gone backwards.
Yeah.
So they're all very interesting ideas.
Yeah.
Because
humanity would never go backwards, right?
No, we always learn from our mistakes. Yeah.
There's no obvious sense in which 3 years ago we were in a better place than we are now. So there was a couple more that I spotted.
Go.
One was The Adventures of Harry Mudd.
Yep.
That was
proposed in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Also, actually, Gary Seven was going to have a spin-off series from the episode Assignment Earth. Him and his cat.
Hey, cool. But we didn't actually talk about the Harry Mudd short written by Rainn Wilson.
And directed by Rainn Wilson.
And starring Rainn Wilson.
Many Rainn Wilsons.
So many Rains.
But we should say at this point that we are going to do an episode on The Meg starring Rainn Wilson.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll get him on the shed.
Well, I've interviewed Rainn Wilson before. I have his Skype
make it
details. I've messaged him.
Can I be there, please?
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I think
he said he would do it when I spoke to him over a year ago.
Yeah. Well, he's not changed since.
I mean,
then.
God knows. Yeah, it's not like he's probably busy or anything.
I think I speak for everyone listening when I say that I want to hear Ty Singh in conversation with Rainn Wilson.
I thought you were going to say cahoots and I'd be up for that too.
And I'm just timing. Yes, I remember you. Oh, this is the author.
This is the author. So they've got Stephen Olsen, who wrote The Meg, has just got in touch saying he's up to be interviewed for our Meg episode. Some of you might know that I'm a character in the fourth Meg book, Hell's Aquarium.
That's true. That's actually true.
That is actually true.
Tell me more, Ty.
You have to buy the book.
Okay. You have to buy the book or listen to our episode on The Meg, which is coming soon. Back to Star Trek. Star Trek 4 is not happening.
Oh, yes. So, well, it might be. Let's not say Star Trek 4.
Okay.
It's confusing.
This is the J.J. Abrams.
The J.J. Abrams one. Basically, that was stalled because Chris Hemsworth and Chris Pine are very expensive. Very handsome, very expensive.
Yeah.
But the plan was to have a time-travelling episode where somehow Kirk goes back in time and meets his father, played by Chris Hemsworth from the first 2009 film. And S.J. Clarkson, female director, was all set up to direct. But apparently negotiations fell down because Paramount wanted to reduce the budget because Star Trek Beyond didn't make as much money as they wanted. And I personally feel Star Trek does better when, let's just say, budget restrictions are put on it because it forces a more creative process. And these films have never had big budgets to begin with until 2009. I think when you have all the resources, you get Star Trek Into Darkness. But while negotiations were hung up, S.J. Clarkson has been named the showrunner and the director of the Game of Thrones spin-off series. So she's gone to do that now, which means essentially Star Trek 4 has been shelved.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be back, but the problem is all the actors are incredibly busy. Zoe Saldana may return to the Marvel Universe, but she's off shooting like 3 or 4 Avatar sequels back-to-back.
Yeah.
And she's got her own stuff going on. Simon Pegg's got his own stuff going on. Zachary Quinto's got his own stuff going on. Chris Pine's probably got so much going on. Wonder Woman films, and that man's always working and is always handsome. John Cho has a career.
Yeah.
Anton Yelchin has tragically passed. Part of me thinks, and I loved Star Trek Beyond, but part of me thinks maybe this part of the Star Trek journey is over.
Yeah.
With these three films, they were great. They rebooted it. They introduced Star Trek to a new generation. Mm. Let's call it a day and then make new feature films down the line, maybe from these new series that are coming.
Discovery feature film?
Mm. I mean,
maybe a bit soon. Bit soon.
You could. I mean, it happened after seven seasons in The Next Generation.
Right.
But, I mean, what I would always propose is instead of spending $150 million on a film starring Chris Pine and co., you could spend $50 million on a film that reunites cast members from Next Gen, DS9 and Voyager. Because they're all set in the same time period.
Yeah.
All those actors now are in their 50s and 60s. Apart from people like Robert Duncan McNeil, Roxanne Dawson, Jonathan Frakes, who are all directors these days. Kate Mulgrew's in Orange is the New Black. Not all of them are really busy. I'm sure you could get them at budget.
Yeah.
You could put together a great Star Trek film featuring, like, a greatest hits of your characters from those shows. You know, Geordi has to team up with Chief O'Brien and Dr. Bashir. And Chakotay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And to save the galaxy. And that would do incredibly well with the Star Trek fan base. And I don't think it would cost that much.
Yeah.
If I was a Paramount exec, I would just throw 30 to 40 million at that project. And I guarantee that would do very well.
Okay. Listen, Toshna, I've just been listening to Ty tell us a lot of stuff there.
I agree.
And, I've been listening too.
Yeah, it's been good. But I couldn't help but wonder, like, I was just thinking he's a bit like the ship's computer, right? You just ask him a question and he just tells you all the stuff.
I was just thinking,
and you didn't even ask for it.
Even possible. All the names in Ty's head. I'm really bad with names, like, really bad with names. And just, you just said so many names in the last 4 minutes. I'm amazed and impressed.
Thank you very much.
But if you... you're a little bit, in my head, like a cross between the ship's computer and Q.
Cool.
Yeah?
I can dig it.
And a bit Neelix. And...
it's the facial hair.
And I actually did one of those things online the other day where you can see what Star Trek character you are. And I honestly, when I think about it, I don't think there's a character in Star Trek that I'm like... But I came out as Bones, which I was okay with.
I mean, would you say he's a Dr. McCoy type?
I can see it.
Bones is grumpy, a little bit racist.
This is true.
Damn it, I'm a podcaster.
He's racist in a charming way, we should say this fact. Calling someone a green-blooded hobgoblin might not go down well in certain HR departments.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see Andrew as grumpy, no, but I could see him being a doctor person, quite kind.
Reckon?
Possibly, but I don't know.
More like the emergency medical hologram.
I could do that.
Yeah, he'd be very calming.
A little bit irascible.
He'd be very calming and soothing.
But, you know, he's got that cultural side. He loves classical music. Your wife's a classical musician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. He sounded a bit like Picard then. So, Maddie... did this quiz. Okay. Maddie's not here, sadly. But Maddie did this quiz and she came out as Jean-Luc Picard.
I mean, that's the goal. We all want to be Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah. I sort of feel like she's a bit more T'Pol than Jean-Luc.
What, a very logical, unnecessarily sexy science officer?
I didn't say that, but...
I mean, that's essentially what T'Pol is. All credit to Jolene Blaylock. She is... incredibly good looking, distractingly so. I mean, I think it was the third episode of Enterprise where they had the unnecessary episode where her and a crew member had to rub gel on each other in a quarantine bay.
Maddie, I hope this isn't making you feel uncomfortable. Mm. You're talking about T'Pol.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. She's very logical. She likes her science.
Yeah, it was the logic and the science bit.
Logic and science.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And Steve.
Mm.
I was kind of thinking a cross between Riker and Tom Paris.
Mm. Okay.
I did the quiz that Andrew did.
Yeah.
And then I did two others because I was like, really? And then they all came to the exact same answer. So, ooh. I mean, and that, of course, be aware that this is how I, because obviously it asks you, are you this? And I'm saying, yes, I am this. I might not be that. They all came out to Kirk. I just couldn't get away from
wow.
it. Over and over, I was Kirk. And this was like a serious long one with 20 questions, which was what the one Andrew sent, and then a BuzzFeed one, and then another one on like a proper Trekkie website. And it was just Kirk over and over again.
Okay, Tushner is Captain Kirk.
I can dig it. Yeah, I mean, I would have said you're more of a B'Elanna Torres.
Yeah, I would go with that.
I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I've got that. A bit of horror in there.
So,
bit fiery, with science. Sure.
Cool. Listen, we've probably been speaking for long enough. We're going to do an episode on Spidey Into the Spider-Verse. We're going to do an episode on the Meg.
And I'm going to leap on Rainn Wilson and see if I can get him on board.
Not physically.
Well, I mean, we'll see what he responds and says. Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Maddie, if you're listening, I just didn't want to say 7 of 9, so I said to Paul, and then it went down that way anyway, so I'm really sorry about that. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you for Ty and Tushner for joining
me
here.
Can I just say that I also did the test?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What did you get?
What do you think I got?
Riker.
I hoped I got Riker. I didn't get Riker.
Data.
I did get
Data. Yes.
And I was surprised.
Really?
Really?
I did it for you and got Data. And thank you very much. Yeah, good. Thank you for joining me, Tushner and Ty.
Always a pleasure.
And hopefully it will be slightly warmer, but no less fun next time.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.